Hello, and welcome to the Fourth Trimester Podcast by Fourth Trimester Bodies Project. I am Ash Luna, and I'm here with my partner.
I am Flowers Luna. Happy to be here.
And we are recording this at about 8:30 in the evening in our studio with two sleeping children, so hopefully this conversation goes okay.
It's going to happen. It's going to go all the way through.
Welcome to our inaugural episode of the Fourth Trimester Podcast. In this episode, we'd like to tell you a little bit about Fourth Trimester Bodies Project, how it started, and what you can expect moving forward in this space.
I have been around for, well, in your life, 3 years, but supporting the project two-ish years. And I think when I explain Fourth Trimester Bodies Project to people and what it's been, I go through like these phases of what Fourth Tri is. So like, can you just like, you know, the people out there that have never heard about you or us, what is it?
Yeah, it's a lot of things. It's hard to put it all in one soundbite. But it began as a feminist art project, as a photo documentary and a storytelling series. I think it still is that, but it's also a political movement. It seeks to normalize what is normal, liberate our bodies, and provide a safe and supportive space for parents and postpartum people to share their stories and create community.
That was a long elevator ride that you just took for that elevator speech, but that is a good picture. I feel like people also need to know that we're an actual group that goes from place to place to meet people.
Sure.
And say, hey, we're in your city. Come meet us. Talk to this group. Take some photos in your underwear.
Yeah.
And let's stay connected and let's see how we can like hold each other up. I feel like that's how like I put it out there.
Yeah, absolutely. That's important. So we're from Chicago. That's home to us. But we travel. I've traveled all over the world. I think our stats are 8 countries and over 100 cities around the world at this point. So yeah, we set up shop, usually with a community partner, and hold space for folks to come in and share their stories. They are photographed in their underwear, sometimes totally nude, sometimes with kiddos, sometimes on their own. And then all of those photos and stories we share online in a gallery on social media. Some of them have been published in a book, and we're working on a second one right now.
Y'all, Ash is really cool. She does a lot of amazing things for a lot of other people.
I'm blushing. You can't see me, but I'm blushing.
You know, she just talked about a book and 1,000 countries and all this stuff. But she does, Ash does a lot. This is a new project that we talked about bringing back up and doing this podcast to find ways to talk about not just Fourth Trimester Bodies Project, but talk about parenting from our eyes and perspectives and histories. Talk about how we're raising our children, how we connect with the world politically. I'm not saying I have the right answers. I don't think either of us are, but we have such vast experiences that we feel like would be good to have conversations about and have other people hear, you know. So it's not just about the project. I feel like that is the motivator for a lot of the things that we'll be talking about. But I think it's mostly about us and about you and bringing all of that together and closer.
Absolutely. Conversations are really important, which is what it feels like you were leading into. We are just people with our own experiences. And we hope that this new endeavor allows us to cross paths with and connect with other folks who have thoughts and opinions and projects out there in the world that they're bringing their lens to, which I think is a cool segue into identity. The personal is political, which is a lot of why I do the work that I do. And I think it's important for folks to know perhaps a little bit more on who we are and why we do what we do. Do you care to share how you identify personally, politically?
Ash had me write my bio today. I left my job a few weeks ago to work with Ash full-time and be a full-time dad, stay-at-home dad. And so I feel like my identity was like turned upside down and I was dipped in this like bucket of reality checking. And don't get me wrong, it's been a beautiful reality checking. So I wrote a bio and Ash read it. And I'm pretty sure in my bio I wrote, the personal is political. I don't think there's anything that I do or live or experience that the world shouldn't know about, or that the world doesn't already know about. And I feel like it's good to speak our truths as humans. For me, as a cisgendered person of color, as a queer person, as a, you know, parent and a bonus dad, I feel like it's good to speak truths so other people can connect and relate. I don't know, I feel like I'll talk about myself more as we go on, but...
Your bio made me cry today. Mm. Because it was an honest portrayal of who you are. You're a really beautiful person and a person that really puts yourself out there in giving to and connecting with others. And it was really cool to see that you were able to see yourself and translate into words as a form of introduction for other people and as a person who has supported the work that I do and this project for years, but is now coming into a role like as an active part of it. With a fancy title and a job position. It was really neat to see those two worlds meld into one.
So. Ash Luna, who are you even?
Who am I even? I'm a human existing on the planet Earth most days. So I took that advice when I started this project from a PR person. And that advice was to keep things as vanilla as possible. Because in the PR worlds and marketing and advertising and publicity, you usually want to appeal to as broad of an audience as possible. You don't want to shake things up too much. You don't want to offend anybody. And what I was doing 6 years ago was innately kind of radical. There wasn't a lot of space where people, particularly women's bodies, were being shown on the internet and photographs in a non-sexual way, in a celebratory way. And so the advice that I took was to kind of tone it down as to who I was and keep things pretty vanilla. And I did. And then I realized as the project grew and I got to meet more people face to face that there was no hiding who I was. And again, the personal is political, not to overuse that phrase, but the work that I'm doing is because of who I am and is because of the experiences that I've had. So I don't feel like I've had any grand coming out, but I feel like I have kind of unsheathed layers of myself as the project has gone on. So yeah, I'm a person who is a parent and is a photographer. I identify as queer. I've always identified as what I have called until recently gender non-committal. I was a tomboy growing up and that felt good, but there was more to it. I wasn't a person that felt any kind of female until I was pregnant with my first kid. And that was cool, but I'm a person with a lot of fluidity who bounces around. So I've very recently been claiming more of a non-binary identity, in part because of what I've learned parenting a kiddo who identifies with their gender in a very fluid way. So, I'm a person, I'm a parent, I'm an artist. I don't know that I consider myself an activist, but activism is very close to my heart and I think integral to the art that I make and the work that I hope to put out in the world.
I don't think there's anything wrong with vanilla. I feel like vanilla is just another way to like describe a degree, you know, or a prism, you know, spectrum of stuff. So like, we're not downing where you are on the spectrum or the degree of how you identify or how you put it out there, right?
Of course, every identity is right. Valid wherever you are, who you are is valid.
I think what Ashley was trying to get at, correct me if I'm wrong, it's you had this experience, you had this life, you had this reality, and when this person was like, oh, you're about to put yourself out there for the world, they don't need to know about all that. They don't need to know about, you know, your gender identity. They don't need to know about your experience with your family, about school, yes, your childhood. Like, can you just cut this out? So I think that's sort of like what you're referencing is finding a ways to make it sort of sugary and attractive to people that might not be able to be like, oh, you're doing this project and you're also this person. Like, no wonder you're taking photos of people in your underwear because you're like all this stuff. And so they were trying to say,
yeah, sure.
Someone was trying to tell you to not talk about your realness.
For sure. Well, and I think there's also a notion there that it's difficult for society to appreciate that people can hold multiple identities, right? So you're a photographer, you're a mother. The times in my career, and you know, being a parent, being a mother, is something I'm incredibly proud of. I don't ever discredit that, but because I'm a working female presenting photographer who is a mother, a big newspaper has done a story on me, and they haven't called me a photographer, even though they're showing my photos. They're calling me a mother, mm-hmm. which is fine, but you're showing my photos. You should be identifying me as a photographer. I think particularly with folks that present as women and anybody who has an identity that might be outside of the, you know, cisgendered heteronormative ideal, it's hard to appreciate multiple identities. So I think mm-hmm. that's a lot of where that advice was coming from.
How did you think about doing this project? How did you think about connecting your worlds together and thinking, I'm doing this and I'm doing it for these reasons and here it is? Like, where did it start, or where does your story start connected to this, to Fourth Star Mr. Bodies Project?
Sure. So I've been a photographer forever. It's the only thing I ever wanted to do, and I'm lucky enough to have actualized that dream and been somebody who's supported myself through photography for the bulk of my adult life. Spent a lot of time working with women and femmes through boudoir and pinup photography, and really got to have a front row seat to the relationship that people have with their bodies. I've always been a pretty body positive person and was raised in a fairly naked household where there was some appreciation. It wasn't perfect, but there was an appreciation for bodies that I really took to heart. And so I had a front row seat through my professional work to the relationship that people have with their bodies. And a lot of it was negative. A lot of the things that my clients would say to themselves or say to me outwardly about their bodies was often really upsetting and concerning. I run a studio that doesn't do any heavy photoshopping or retouching, don't do any body sculpting. So people coming to work with me knew that they were getting a body positive experience, but still the dialogue that they had was something that we were constantly trying to reframe. But that was kind of an external conversation for me. Where are these comments coming from? Where are these notions of imperfection that these folks are dealing with? You know, where do they stem from? And a lot of that is society. A lot of that is our families of origin. A lot of it is what is served to us passively our whole lives in the media, on billboards, magazines, that sort of thing. But it was, as I said, an external conversation for me until it wasn't. And it was my journey through parenthood that really shifted that for me. Our eldest kiddo, Xavier, is 13 now. And while his pregnancy and birth wasn't what I had expected it to be, it was still pretty awesome. I got pregnant young, 23. It was, a planned-ish pregnancy at a time in my life where I felt ready for that, even though I was quite young. I had planned to deliver at home with a midwife. A very healthy pregnancy. I felt awesome watching my body grow. As I mentioned earlier, it was like a really cool experience in awakening my feminine side of things and really being able to embrace that for the first time ever. He arrived quite early, 28 weeks, without any indication that that was going to happen. But all things said, he was delivered vaginally in hospital very quickly, no complications, and he had a really short NICU stay. We had a really awesome breastfeeding relationship. And I came out the other side of things just kind of feeling like a badass. My body changed a lot through pregnancy and postpartum with him, but all in ways that I was able to kind of marvel over and appreciate. And again, I was young, so perhaps there was some naivety at play there. That changed pretty drastically for me 6 years later when I found myself pregnant again, this time not in a place or time where pregnancy was the best idea. I considered terminating that pregnancy. I had terminated a pregnancy before, and so that wasn't really a taboo topic for me. If that was the right decision, it was a decision that I was happy to navigate. But I decided that I wanted to continue the pregnancy. I had really wanted to grow my family. Even if I had to go it alone as a parent of that child, I was going to see it through. And so again, I sought the care of midwives, thinking, as everybody did, that my first preterm delivery was just kind of a fluke. Planned a home birth again with a little more watchful eye, but I learned at 15 weeks pregnant that I was actually 17 weeks pregnant with not one baby, but two.
This is the second time you've mentioned home birth.
Yeah.
And for your pregnancy with Xavier, which is your first born and your pregnancy with the twins, you mentioned wanting to do a home birth. Before I met you, like, I think I might have, like, heard about home births or... And I'm like, you know, I'm 36 and my mom came from a family of 11 children, which... And like a year ago, I found out that my grandma birthed all 11 children at home. I'm surprised I didn't know about this sooner, but what led you to want that? Not only at your first birth, what made you want that for yourself and for your child and for your story?
Yeah, so I'm not certain. I don't have an easy answer to that. I think just the evolution of me as a person. I worked as a nanny for many years before I became a parent myself. So I had experience with a variety of kiddos who were, you know, gestated and birthed in different ways. I also trained as a doula when I was unknowingly very early in my pregnancy with Xavier. So I think the knowledge gained there informed my decisions a bit. Mm. More than anything, I think I felt capable of delivering at home. I viewed pregnancy as a physiologically normal part of life. And unless something was going wrong or went wrong, or I needed a higher level of care, being in the hospital didn't seem to be the right choice for me. I think folks that choose to birth in hospitals for any reason should absolutely be supported in that. But for me, it just didn't feel like the right choice.
Cool. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah.
I mean, you'll talk about this person in a bit, but like, you know, home birth is all I know about, sure, you know, people being born now. And that's all I can envision. And, you know, the fact that it's a choice and something that you wanted and something that you felt like was your, the only way to go. Like, and what was this, 2006?
2005, Xavier was born, yeah.
Wanting that, I think, is a big indicator as to who you are and why this project is going the way that it is, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Twins, yeah. So I was 17 weeks with them when I learned that there were two of them. And I, at that point, they were healthy. They were perfect. Had an ultrasound that provided dates. We're pretty sure at that point that they were identical Modi twins, for anybody who knows what that means. For those of you who don't, that means they were sharing a placenta as identicals do, but had their own amniotic sacs, which is a safer presentation than identicals that share an amniotic sac. I was over the moon, but the good news brought some bad news and that I immediately risked out of my home birth midwife's care. But they were pretty awesome about it. They were willing to see me, provide orders as I needed while I took my time interviewing another care provider and making a decision for me. At that point, I wasn't certain whether I would be seeking OB care or if I would be trying to find a midwife practice that might give me the option to deliver twins vaginally or deliver twins at home. But I had no reason to worry. They were perfect. They were healthy. Things were good. My home birth midwives had given me an order for our 20-week anatomy scan in the event that I hadn't yet found another care provider. So around 19 weeks, I went ahead and went in for that scan, and everything changed. I say that the veil of naivety was forever pulled from my eyes. Anybody that has ever experienced a miscarriage or a loss or a pregnancy complication knows that the second that ultrasound wand hits your belly and something's wrong, there's no poker face in the world that can, you know, hide the tech's reaction to a degree that an expected parent can't feel that something's wrong.
And also, this is just shy of halfway through a typical pregnancy.
Sure.
So the things that typically happen is like you're going to ultrasounds, you're getting checks, you're getting levels of fluid and, you know, your vitals and stuff. So it's like this is not something that was anywhere near on your radar.
No, and I, like so many people, thought, you know, when I learned I was carrying twins, that it was just this magical experience. I was getting two babies out of this, two babies that would forever be connected in beautiful ways. I learned that twins actually ran in my grandfather's side of the family. I started seeing twins everywhere. I felt like a unicorn that this was happening. And so this ultrasound, Xavier, who was six at the time, was with me. I had no reason to feel concerned, but the tech left the room. We waited for a very long time, about 45 minutes. alone before somebody came in and said that my midwife was on the phone in the hallway, a public hospital hallway. And I picked up the phone and she said, "I'm really sorry to tell you this, but your babies are dying." I don't know how I retained anything else she said, because I remember wanting to slam the phone down and just run away and unhear what she said. Ultimately, I was diagnosed with stage 4. The twins were diagnosed with stage 4 twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome. Stage 5 TTTS means that one or both of the babies have already died. So we were in crisis mode. There was a huge size and fluid discrepancy. I was experiencing polyhydramnios or excessive amniotic fluid. And I was told that I needed to see an MFM immediately before the babies both died and before my health was compromised. Living in Chicago, I thought that we had care options aplenty. And that wasn't the case at the time. There were only about 8 surgeons in the U.S. Qualified to do the surgery that I needed to try to sever the vessel connections between my twins. Surgery was an option. Terminating the pregnancy entirely was an option. Selectively aborting one of the twins in hopes that the other did better was an option. For me at that point, trying to save them both was the only option. They were my babies. They had names. They were wanted and planned for at that point and anticipated. But again, there was only 9 days between when I learned that there were 2 of them and this moment. So it was from like the highest high to the lowest low.
But I also imagine like in those 9 days, was it 17 weeks where you went in, you found out you were carrying twins? 9 days, not a lot of time. But sure. To get the news saying you had twins, you dreamt up of everything. Everything doubled, mm-hmm. literally and figuratively, in your heart and in your mind. And so you get to 19 weeks and there's like this immediate crumble and this immediate intensity that has you making immediate decisions and having immediate thoughts about what next.
Sure. And I knew that this was a possibility, right? I had friends who had miscarried, who had babies stillborn, who had premature deliveries. But it's one of those things that you don't think can ever happen to you until it does. I took the choice to go to St. Louis for an intrauterine fetal surgery just before 20 weeks, which I was told gave me about 50-50 chance of Nova or Survivor surviving, and about a 25% chance of Aurora surviving. I was willing to take the chance. I was awake during surgery. They just give you a spinal block, which was really wild to be able to see the babies inside me on the scope and see what was happening. It was really beautiful. The last shot of the video on the scope is Aurora seemingly waving at the camera, which was really cool. Our surgeon decided that the surgery was successful. He drained 2 liters of amniotic fluid in addition to the laser surgery that was performed and placed a cerclage because I had started to dilate prematurely. And I went to sleep that night with like the most peace I think I've ever had in my whole life. My babies were going to be okay. I was okay. And I felt really great. So the roller coaster continues. The next morning we woke up and they went to discharge us to send us home and decided to do one last ultrasound. I'd had hourly ultrasounds after the surgery until the middle of the night when they had stopped. And they took me down. Everybody was in great spirits, ready to send me back to Chicago to continue what was supposed to be a healthy pregnancy. And again, that wand hit my belly. And I knew something was bad. I wasn't sure what was bad, but I knew that something was wrong. And the tech got quiet, and then the surgeon came in, and he put his hand on mine, and he said, "I'm sorry, Aurora's dead."
This story is, from what I imagine, always going on inside of you, and etc. Sure. You also tell this story
all the time.
At this depth and emotion at least 3 times a month.
Yeah.
From what listeners will know is we travel, right? And we share stories and it's different sort of here and there, but you go through this all the time. And yeah, there's a pause there because I feel like there's usually a pause there because that's the moment where you talk about the wand hitting your belly. And I feel like that's where something comes back to you. Some other feeling comes back.
That moment in Technicolor. You know, it is slow motion, the words, the feeling, the smells, the sounds of the room. I'm a visual person, but I don't feel like I have vivid memories of most things, but I could tell you what everybody in that room was wearing and what it smelled like and what the lighting was. And, you know, there's like a snapshot of that moment. I learned that my baby was dead. That will never leave. And then what do you do? I was in a hospital in St. Louis. There was nothing more they could do for me. So they sent me home within an hour. I had to get in a car and drive 6 hours back to Chicago. Silent. I think I said a word. I think I cried a lot. I think I sent some messages on my phone. And then the process of grieving and growing continued. One thing that I always make a point to tell people, it's not something that most folks want to hear, but when you're pregnant with twins, particularly identical twins, and one of your baby dies, they don't just magically disappear. They aren't born. You continue your pregnancy with both of your babies inside you. And so I went on for weeks with a growing, fighting baby inside me and a dead baby inside me. Mm. I had ultrasounds every 3 or 4 days, and I got to see both of my babies. It was really difficult existing in a world as a person that looked very pregnant. At 24 weeks, I was measuring 54 weeks pregnant. I still don't understand how that's possible, but I was. And so I got all the questions that pregnant people do. Oh my gosh, you must be carrying twins. Are you due tomorrow? Oh, tell me about your babies. And I had to decide every question, every day, every moment when I was just trying to buy a carton of milk. Do I tell this person my truth or do I give them some pretty version of reality so I don't upset them? The next part of my story I feel like could go on forever, so I'll switch to the Cliff Notes version, but everybody thought that there was a possibility my pregnancy would continue typically. Sometimes in these circumstances, pregnancies do, but in my case, I developed an E. coli infection from the TTTS surgery and delivered via emergency cesarean at 24 weeks. Gave birth to a stillborn Aurora, and a minute before that, a tiny 1 pound Nova who was fighting very hard to be here, but was very sick, was septic, was tiny, was not breathing or doing anything on their own. Nova went to NICU. I woke up in recovery alone, and the trauma continued. Nova's NICU stay was fraught with difficulty. Their first week of life, Nova developed a very severe bilateral brain bleed. Mm. And I was told that the most humane thing to do would be to take them off of life support and let them die. Having quite literally just held a dead baby in my arms wasn't an option to not fight for them. I had been fighting for weeks already, and I wasn't about to say, fine, take them. My hospital wouldn't listen, couldn't do anything. I was told there was no option, so I left the NICU and went to the cafeteria and Googled and called neurosurgeons at hospitals all around the country and was told the same thing. You know, we've looked at your baby's scans and there isn't any hope. I'm sorry, there's nothing we can do. The most humane thing you can do is to take them off life support and let them die. And when I was about to heed their advice, I heard back from a neurosurgeon, amazingly in Chicago, where we live. And he said, I can't make any promises, but I'll try. Bring your baby to our NICU. We have space, and they can stay here. And if they reach a point where they are strong enough and healthy enough to go through surgery, we'll try. Nova was transferred to the NICU on my 30th birthday, and we waited and waited, and they slipped away multiple times. But when Nova was 94 days old, they were finally big enough to undergo brain surgery to have a VP shunt placed, and came home 6 days later. So while Nova is a person that will live with disabilities for the rest of their life, they're here and amazing and hilarious, and we get to listen to them laugh and carry on every single day.
Nova is not just here. Nova is like, I've had amazing pleasure of being in Nova's life and being Nova's bonus dad for about 3 years. And Nova is about 15 feet from us, snoring after just watching a show. Nova has jokes. Nova runs around and, like, likes to be chased by make-believe monsters. Nova will skip down the street singing songs that they say they composed themselves. If I didn't know, like, this story of yours and Nova's from their birth and the loss of Aurora, and if I couldn't see sort of, like, you know, Nova wears braces on their legs to help with walking, if I couldn't see those, I'd be like, oh, that's just like a typical, funny, hilarious kid. Nova's got a lot of other stuff going on and will be a child with disabilities, physical disabilities, developmental, right, for the rest of their life. But, like, when they're at their peak, like, man, they are in it.
Yeah.
Today, they were doing this, like, evil villain laugh, like, pretending to cook, like, a dangerous meal. And they would, like, sneak this laugh, and I'm not going to do it. One day, I'll have them record it. I could not stop laughing. It was the creepiest, funniest sound. Anyway, all that's to say that this person has rocked their own world and is living it and, like, does not let anything hold them back. They get tired from time to time, but, like, will push just like they did when they were a wee. Having this surgeon say, sure, I'll try, like, just sort of, like, pushing those boundaries and getting through. Anyway, it's a little plug for Nova.
Yeah, Nova's really rad. Nova has hot pink and purple hair right now.
Yeah, there's that too.
I think that's what most people need to know about Nova right now. So yeah, so there's that. And I was on autopilot.
You meet a lot of people.
Yeah.
In this world, and especially in this project. And you tell your story, you probably tell other stories.
Mm-hmm.
And people definitely tell you their stories.
I love people's stories.
Has anybody ever said, that was my experience and, like, my story was a little bit different at the end?
Yeah.
Because it sounds like you did everything to get someone to hear you out.
Sure.
You talked to everyone to get someone to consider something. And, like, what are the chances that, like, it seems like right at the end of you having to, like, you're going to have to make a decision sooner or later, the person from Chicago pops up and says, huh, okay.
Yeah.
Not everybody has access to that. Not everybody who has similar experience to you lives in Chicago, has the resources, right, has the privilege and being fortunate enough to be able to do that. Has anybody been like...
Unfortunately, yeah, I won't say frequently, but the world gets to be a really small place when you put yourself out there.
Yep.
And I think especially in the early years of the project, I was doing a lot of outreach to specifically connect with twin families and to families affected by twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome. Again, I had never heard of it until I learned that it was killing my babies. And I think that was the most upsetting thing as a person who finds myself otherwise to be well-educated and well-informed was that I was pregnant with twins and nobody had mentioned to me that there was cause for concern, let alone something that kills more babies every year than SIDS, which we all know about, right? So I've heard a lot of stories and some are beautiful. Some end with two full-term healthy babies after having a diagnosis just like mine. Some end with no babies. Some end with a baby that was born alive and didn't make it, or a baby whose disabilities are more profound. There's variations of the same story out there in a community of parents who I think very much like me feel a little bit robbed by something that snuck up on them.
And I ask this question because this goes, and this will connect to podcasts and other stories, you know, out there, and this comes up a lot in the circles where we share on tour stops with four trimester bodies. People feel like they're not given all the options, all the resources to keep their health, maintain their health, to save their children, to minimize trauma and injury. And it's hard, right? Because you put your trust in this institution or this, you know, these people who should be caring for your well-being. And I'm sure this wasn't the first time it was Dr. Tamita. I'm sure, is that the first time? he did something like this, like he did to Noah?
Oh, I'm sure
not. Not the first time he did that. And so how wasn't someone, and I met this person, I'm sure a lot of doctors in the country know him. Sure. How wasn't someone like, you know, I read an article where Dr. Tamita, they couldn't say that to you? Or is there some sort of oath that people couldn't be like, you know, not me, but I know something, or I know someone, or I heard a story?
Yeah, it's really frustrating. And not only with Nova's neurosurgery journey, but once I got myself to the other side of my 2-2-TS journey, I've learned that, you know, of this handful of surgeons across the country, there's one surgeon who's really good at cases like mine. I have an anterior placenta. So there's one surgeon who has like a 80%+ success rate with folks who present with this type of placenta. Whereas the surgeon that I went to has like a 15% success rate. Nobody told me that. Nobody shared that. Like, why isn't there a forum for disseminating this information that people have access to via their medical providers? Yeah. When you're in it, you know, I found this out from other parents once it was too late for me. I'm grateful to have been able to since pass that information along to other parents who are still in it. But yeah, it's really frustrating to be on the other side and feel like an informed person who advocates well, who's still been in a situation where there was clearly information out there that was not shared and was not within my grasp.
Yeah, that's something that I feel like needs some sort of big reform or something, right? Where someone should be able to give you a person or a team or right. Someone that's able to help out.
Yeah, and I think that applies to so many other situations too. Like, I think my circumstance is viewed as something that's a little bit more extreme, but I feel like that happens in everyday pregnancy and birth situations as well. Folks aren't informed of all of their choices or supported or connected in the best ways. So as pregnant, birthing, parental people, I think as a whole, that's something that I would love to see change for us in this lifetime.
From being in touch with Dr. Tamita and undergoing and starting that procedure and process of making decisions, what happened from there?
So Nova's here, right? Nova's life was saved. Nova was able to come home. But I was on autopilot that whole time from my TTTS diagnosis in utero to quite literally the moment I walked out of the NICU doors with Nova at 100 days old. I was just getting through the day. Every day I had a friend who's a NICU nurse. Hi, Angie. Send me supportive messages. And one of my favorite was, it's okay if today all you did was breathe. And so many days were like that. It was a flurry of research, or it was sitting quietly, or it was pumping milk, or it was taking a picture. But it was just autopilot getting through the day. And there's a photo of me standing outside the NICU doors with Nova on our homecoming day. And I remember sharing that photo and everybody saying, you look so happy. Oh my gosh, you're taking your baby home. How beautiful. And 6 years later, I look at that picture and all I see is pain, because it was the first time that my body, my soul, my spirit really felt the physical weight or lack thereof of bringing home one baby instead of two. I didn't feel, oh my gosh, I'm taking my baby home. I felt, oh my gosh, I'm not taking their twin with me.
And maybe you said this already, but that day you got to take Nova home, you had spent 100 days in the NICU. Yeah. Like, Nova's life and your life together wasn't starting right there. You had 100 days of worry and pain and fear.
Yeah, of alarms and losing them over and over and over again.
So that photo, I mean, and all the people saying that, those things, it's like, no, like, this isn't where we're starting. Like,
yeah,
it was a long way to get here, and that's what I'll remember.
This episode is brought to you by author and illustrator Liz Ryan. Liz's first book, My Mommy Had a Miscarriage, is available now on Amazon.com.
Years after suffering a miscarriage, Liz Ryan realized that there was not a book that addressed miscarriage as a resource for young children. She decided to use the experience written on her heart and wrote and illustrated My Mommy Had a Miscarriage for families, friends, and communities to walk through together. Her hope is to open the lines of communication in a way that children can understand, as well as adults who have not walked this path.
Liz is a friend and Fourth Trimester Bodies Project participant, and she hand-delivered a copy of this book to us when we shot with her earlier this year in Akron, Ohio. The book is beautifully illustrated. She's done all the illustrations herself. And even though our family has not personally experienced miscarriage, our surviving twin Nova loves reading it. So I think it's a really important read for any family that's navigated any type of loss, or anybody that just wants to expose themselves or their family to this reality for others.
My Mommy Had a Miscarriage by Liz Ryan is available on Amazon.com right now.
So we came home. I'm self-employed, which means that I was able to assemble a crew to keep my photo studio running for most of the time that Nova was in NICU. But once they got home, I had to go right back to work. Day one, back in the studio, photographing clients, answering emails, doing edits. And something about that hyperspeed push back to reality like woke me up even more to how I was feeling. And I went from being this body positive person that felt empowered and in charge and in control of my experience and in love with my body to being a person that felt utterly broken. I felt like I had failed as a human, as a mother. You hear this phrase and sometimes this meme goes around social media that says, congrats, it's okay if the only thing you did today was keep your kids alive. Some of us have a day where we didn't keep our kids alive, whether that happens during pregnancy or after birth. I hadn't done the one job as a parent we're told we need to do, which is keep our babies safe and alive and well. And then there was the trauma. I think every NICU parent experiences some degree of PTSD. And I've since come to terms with like the very real traumas that I experienced, but was just kind of scratching the surface on what that all meant. I was in a really bad place. I would lock myself in the bathroom, in the shower and cry. I couldn't look at half of my body. No shame to anybody who chooses or needs to deliver via cesarean. Nova is alive because they were able to get them out when they did. But for me, that felt like another example of how my body hadn't done what it wanted to do. My body awesomely knew that there was infection and danger and was trying to get my babies out. But my medical team was simultaneously trying to keep my babies in before they realized what was happening. And so the cesarean, but then my body didn't heal. They had to have a cesarean revision. A surgeon tried to operate on me without anesthesia in a hospital room versus a surgical suite. That incision then had to heal open, which was a process that for me was really grotesque and caused me to disassociate with my body quite a bit. And so all of those things culminated with this conversation that I'd had with my clients for years. I had been asking myself, what happens in these people's lives that they look at themselves through this lens that I can't see? I see them as beautiful, powerful, strong, wonderful people. And all of a sudden it clicked. They have some dialogue, they have some experience, and it takes that from you. And I wanted to change that. As an artist and a storyteller, that's how I navigate the world. And so I started sharing my story with friends, with family along the way. Being in the NICU is very isolating. So a lot of my communication was online or was digitally with friends and family members. And, so many people showed up in the beginning and then slowly faded away. It's not a funny joke, but I joke that our friends were worried they were going to catch a dead baby. And the shame and the stigma became layered and layered and layered. I heard time and again that, you shouldn't talk about this. You shouldn't share this story. You're going to scare people. When I was screaming, I wish I had known that this could happen to me. I wish I had known that there were resources available if and when this ever did happen, that I could have accessed before it was too late. And so I kind of came to a place where I said, fuck that. I was working anyway, and I wanted to see people who looked like me. I wanted to hear stories that looked like mine. I wanted to hear stories, period. I wanted to hear triumphant stories. I wanted to hear tragic stories. I wanted to hear every story in between. To backtrack a bit, when Nova was in NICU, in a phase of wanting to see myself represented somewhere, and I'm a fairly privileged person. I'm thinnish, able-bodied, white. I'm represented in a lot of ways in mainstream culture and media. I went to Google and put in cesarean revision scar, postpartum twin belly, stretch marks. I wanted to see an image that felt beautiful of somebody who'd been through what I had, and it didn't exist. Instead, there were ads for plastic surgeons. There were magazine covers about celebrities whose bodies had bounced back. No mention of the personal trainers that they had worked with. just an image saying, this is normal. You should look like this too. And this dialogue about bouncing back or snapping back, that we should somehow get back to something that we were before. Nothing about us evolving through this process, which is what I wanted to see. So I wanted to change that. And the only way that I felt like I could was by being the first one to kind of jump off the cliff, so to speak. So I quite sheepishly, almost 6 years ago now, took a photo of myself in my underwear. I like to tell people that it was one of the rattiest pair of underwear that I owned. I would
every
love...
Every time you say that when we're talking in a group, I laugh so hard. And like, I don't laugh out loud. Because the first couple times I was like, oh, how ratty? Because I went to college and I wore the same underwear for like a good 5, 6, 7 years. And I know ratty. But if any of you ever see this book, you can see a couple of, you know, well-loved undies on
it. Yeah, it was, you know, and I would like to say that I launched this project with all the pre-production work in mind, that it was polished and well thought out. And in my heart it was, but in reality, I had to jump in. I had to fake it until I made it, just like every, you know, just like half of my participants do. And it was my most comfortable pair of underwear. But y'all, it's like a pair of black bikini briefs from the Target $5 bin. And there's some lace trim that is falling off on one side. They're not the cutest. But that's what I had on that day. And Nova was 5 months post-NICU and needed to nurse. And so I took it all off and took a self-portrait of Nova and I nursing. You can see my cesarean scar. You can see some of my surgical scars. You can see some of Nova's scars and Nova's shunt quite predominantly in the photo. And I posted it first to my personal Facebook page. I didn't even have a website or an email address set up yet. And I asked friends. 19 friends was my first goal. I thought maybe we could do a gallery show with 20 photos. And then I thought maybe we could put together a book with 100 photos. And this work will be done. My job will be done here. I can say I did this thing of normalizing bodies and stories. About 6 weeks into this idea that I had, Huffington Post heard of the project somehow and ran a story on it. And I woke up the next morning to 6,000 emails from people, mostly women, mostly mothers, from all around the world who said, oh my goodness, this is amazing. Thank you for doing this, but also how do I participate? How can I join this? And so it began. You know, I was able to quickly shift gears and feel really grateful to have been able to do so. Started touring. My first photo went public in June. By August, I was on the road capturing photos and stories of folks all over the country, eventually all over the world. Created a space online, social media, on a website where I could showcase these photos and these stories of amazing, powerful humans who were somehow on the other side of parenting. Some folks that had carried and birthed babies themselves, some folks that had carried and lost babies. I've worked with adoptive parents and foster parents and bonus parents. And the project has continued to evolve. My story is but one of thousands at this point. And every couple of years, I say, it might be nice to move on to something else, to refocus or start a new project about something I'm passionate about. And then there's a new crop of parents that are born, and there's participants I've worked with before who have more kids or who want to share something else about their journey. And I say, no, this is where it's at. This is important. This work needs to carry on. If you go to Google now and put in those search terms that I put in when Nova was still in NICU, you see our images. There's an archive of bodies, postpartum, the scars and skin and stretch marks. Bodies much different from what media had served us for so long. And it's not just my work. There's other photographers, movements that have come to light in the past 6 years, and they're all so beautiful and all so important and also needed.
And I'm part of the project in a lot of supportive ways, and as to describe it as an outsider because I still very much feel like I'm still learning kind of what this means to people. And the reason why I still feel that way is that every time we go to a new city and a new town, people are still healing. People yeah. are still seeking community, and they're needing to have those conversations and to be a part of something that they feel like, I'm not the only one.
Yeah.
That's like, that's the biggest thing that I hear every single time is, I needed to know that I wasn't the only one. And so they're sitting in this room of, you know, 10 to 20 people that have different stories, and they get to be a part of that. And so that's real, right? And that's out there, and that's difficult, and that's beautiful. You know, the project, I feel like, is a nice, loving connector to that. Yeah. Because it can be these stories. It can be someone just scrolling through Instagram, seeing the photos and saying,
"For sure.
Ooh, look at that body," or "look at that scar," or, you know, and feeling safe from that,
yeah,
feeling accepted from that, I think is a beautiful thing.
Thank you. Yeah, that community is so important. And my favorite thing about publicly sharing these images and stories is not only the support that the participant receives, but every photo that goes out there, every story that's shared, there's at least one comment, very often many more, that say, "Oh my goodness, that's my body. I didn't know anybody out there looked like me," or "That's my story. There's so many parallels into my experience. And I thought that I was alone. I thought that I was the only person." Parenthood can feel so isolating. I feel like it's something that those of us that choose to be parents share in so many ways, but the nitty-gritty of it is done in the moments where it's dark and messy and noisy. And for far too long, we've tried to sugarcoat that version and not talk about the things that are really important to talk about. So that's another element of, I think, why we're here and why these stories are so important. I never imagined that I would be the first person that so many people shared their story with. I think as we started touring, that was quite a surprise for me. I thought that before folks leapt into something so public, they would have processed. They would have been ready, air quotes there, ready, right? But they weren't. This is the starting point for so many people. And we've been fortunate enough to hold space and be the recipients of the very beginning stages of processing for so many people. And there's a lot of power in that. There's a lot of vulnerability in that.
We have this project going strong. This podcast reaching out in a different way, connecting hands, holding on to folks and their stories in a different way. There's potentially a new book coming out.
Potentially. There is a new
there
book.
Is a, there's a new book coming out. There is also this tiny human. Like, you know, whatever. We could talk about them. Because, like, it's just a sort of like a different kind of story and way we talk about this person who's about to wake up. Right at the end of...
You hear their nursing chunks. Should we tell the story of our little happy ending here?
So Solis is 6 months old. And we decided to have a baby.
How candid should we be about the backstory here? Should we tell about me choking on Indian food, or is that too much?
Nah, they could... Okay. They could come to a tour stop.
Okay.
I think this meant a lot for Ash and for me. I don't think this is something, especially Ash, envisioned or thought would happen. Not just having another human, but having this kind of human when, you know, we think about and talk about Ash's other experiences through birth. Ash and I got to have Sol at home, two floors from where I'm standing right now. And it was a beautiful space and a beautiful time on a Sunday afternoon, October 21st, 2018, with lovely people there, just the right people there. And it was, I think that was when I saw Ash step into this strong, beautiful person that I know she is, with her strong body and the way that I know she is inside, but there was fear sort of clouding that. think throughout our pregnancy, it was really scary for Ash because everything that involved pregnancy was really scary in her past and painful. And so to Ash, there was no relief until this human was in her arms. There's no letting go of that breath until this person, this human, let out a breath. And we couldn't have asked for a more precious event in our lives. So they're here, they're growing, they're connected to the other humans in our life, and it's, I'm kind of scared to say it, but it's almost perfect. So, yeah.
It's a beautiful new chapter, and it has been healing. Pregnancy after loss is a trip, but it's something that I'm really grateful to have been able to navigate, particularly with you, with such a supportive partner, such a connected, involved partner. It's my first time doing this with a counterpart, and that has been really magical. And to give birth to a baby and them just be a normal part of our life and our family and our home from the first second that they existed outside of my body with the big kids with us has been really, really amazing. And to watch them develop in ways that had to be facilitated for the big kids is really wonderful as well. It's happy, sad sometimes, but it's really cool. Mm. Yeah, and we have this new chapter. I don't think I fully understood why people came back to the project and came back to this work. I thought my story as a parent was done, or at least as a birthing person was done after the twins. To have this new chapter with you and with them, with our lives, with our work, is really, really cool.
That is Fourth Trimester Bodies Project. And it's evolving, and it's growing, and it's exciting. Yeah.
Is this the end? Is this the end of episode one? The inaugural podcast? I can't say that word. I need to stop trying.
I can't believe you got it out there. I would have looked it up and said it six times before.
Yeah. So this is our story. We really wanted to start with, on a personal note, very often I do the work that I do online and social media and at events, and I assume that everybody knows me or knows my backstory or knows why I do what I do or who I am. But that's not the case. And so we wanted to put somewhere in time a placeholder of these moments and who we are and what we do and why we do it. We hope to move forward and share this space with other parents, with other participants. We'll be revisiting interviews and stories of folks who have participated in the project. We'll be diving into some of the politics of being a person and being a parent. We hope to chat with some folks that are experts in things that...
You know, you just covered all of life when you said the politics of being a person. It's like, oh, okay, cool. So, like, everything.
Everything.
Which is... what we want. Oh, hi. Good morning.
So I you should woke probably up go the back baby. To sleep.
It's everything. It's not just about the project. In fact, we'll be talking very little about the project. I feel like this is an introduction to that.
Sure.
And understanding sort of like what the guiding light is. But moving forward, it'll be, you know, talking about race, class, gender, talking about
sexuality, bodies, parenthood.
Yeah.
Yeah, all of the things. So we hope you come back and you join us. You can subscribe to this feed and be notified of podcasts. You can leave us a 5-star review so other folks will be able to see that this podcast exists. You can share it with your friends and your family.
We are on Facebook, Fourth Trimester Bodies Project. We are on Instagram, Fourth Trimester Bodies Project.
Twitter, Tumblr. At Fourth Trimester Bodies Project, all of the places. You can also email us hello@fourthtribodies.com. Yeah, we hope to see you back here. We have this cool new tagline for the project. Are we closing on that note?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I have to say it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we hope you came for the pretty pictures and stay for the movie.
Hey
Hey, this is Ash.
And this is Flowers.
We wanted to tell you about a few upcoming tour stops for Fourth Trimester Bodies Project. On April 28th, we will be in Quad Cities, Davenport, Iowa, with Motherhood Matters. On the 12th of May, which happens to be Mother's Day, we will be in LA at Loom. June 7th and 8th, we'll be in New York City. And the 9th, we will be in the Hamptons with East End Birth Network. And on June 22nd, we'll be in Anchorage, Alaska with Midwifery and Women's Health of Geneva Woods.
These tour stops are all available on our website at fourthtribodies.com. You can go on there, click on book a session, or check out tour events and event schedule information, and sign up. There is a fee for all events. We do offer scholarships, so if money is a factor, please reach out to us. Do not let that hold you back from participating.
The best way to do that is, again, via the website, fourthtribodies.com, or via email, hello@fourthtribodies.com. We hope to see you on the road.